Hello everyone and welcome to JFG tonight for a review of the news. How are you doing, people of the regular chat? Firestarter says, lol, the two guy looks scared. It's not two guys. It's a father and his trans daughter dressed as a boy. And it's on Fox News. All of this to say, I made an error in the title. I realized that I wrote Fox News equals CNN plus 4 years. The true equation should be Fox News plus 4 years equals CNN. That is, Fox News is at the is just 4 years late on what CNN does. Fox News promoting transgenderism in a teenager, which in another world could be okay if it was really a documentary that goes in depth. And that says, okay, we're going to present the wrongs of it and the pros of it. But it's a feel-good little report, journalistic report, where everything seems great and where the solution of sex change is presented as so much better because the alternative is suicide, of course. We wouldn't have this person in our life if we hadn't done the sex change, because they would have committed suicide. And it doesn't touch at all the problem of reproduction and the fact that you've just sterilized your child. The fact that it doesn't approach these negatives and presents it as positive, unfortunately, in the current cultural context, is playing in the LGBT propaganda, the sterilizing propaganda that we are seeing from the left. And Fox News should have been much more responsible than this if they want to touch the subject. If we were in a world where transgenderism is rare and it's only a matter of presenting their stories so that more people get to know what it's about, that might be okay. But in a world where there is such pressure on young girls and young boys to disassociate from the gender that nature gave them, is absolutely scandalous. And it shows that Fox News shouldn't be counted on. It's great that Tucker is there. It's great that Tucker is normalizing certain subjects that other hosts would not normalize on the right. But it's not going to be enough. Fox News will end up like all of the leftist outlets. Silicon Valley corporations are taking control of history. Twitter has imposed a week-long suspension on the account of writer and political activist Danny Apfong for a thread he made on the platform disputing the mainstream Tiananmen Square massacre narrative. His tweet said the following: every June 4th, Western propagandists remind us of the Tiananmen Square massacre to smear China. The truth? No massacre occurred on the square, and the violence that took place in Beijing during that time was part of a failed color revolution backed by the United States. So I guess that it's the part where he says no massacre has occurred on the square that annoyed Twitter. Denial of a historical event of death, a well-documented historical event. In any case, if he hadn't been censored, I would have never heard about this perspective, which is quite interesting. This idea that the Tiananmen Square was basically a color revolution pushed by the US, that doesn't surprise me, but I had never heard that. I think it makes total sense in light of what the US has done in other places of the world. But it's absolutely scandalous that on the internet we are unable to discuss just historical events and perspectives on those. Of course, I'm guessing that his tweet went against the intelligence community narrative and the very people who organized those coups and revolutions. That is so sad that the internet has reached this point. Firestarter says, I doubt June 4th was CIA. John Drake says, it's true, it was a CIA plot. I don't know. I didn't even know that there was this perspective on this event, but I know that troubles in countries almost never rises naturally. There's always someone manipulating the strings behind the veil. So I'm open to the idea. I would have liked to see his full Twitter thread, but now he's been censored. In any case, other cases of censorship. Colin Wright, PayPal has notified me that after a review, we have decided to permanently limit your account. I used PayPal to receive both one-time and recurring donations from my supporters. When I asked why, they said I needed an attorney to submit a subpoena to find out. You can no longer do business with PayPal. I don't even know who Colin Wright is. His bio on Twitter says evolutionary biologist, journalist, founding editor of Reality's Last Stand, contributing editor at Quillette. Quillette sometimes has been an open forum back in the days, but I think it's veered into a leftist shit show. So I don't know who he is. Perhaps we should get him to read the Revolutionary Phenotype and see what he thinks. He claims to be an evolutionary biologist. That is interesting. The story of Fox News and the failure of conservatism in America has been very well expressed in this quote that was sent by Vol on the regular chat. I don't know who this guy is, it's not written. But he says, it may be inferred again that the present movement for women's rights will certainly prevail from the history of its only opponent, Northern conservatism. This is a party which never conserves anything. Its history has been that it demurs to each aggression of the Progressive Party and aims to save its credit by a respectable amount of growling, but always acquiesces at last in the innovation. What was the resisted novelty of yesterday is today one of the accepted principles of conservatism. It is now conservative only in affecting to resist the next innovation, which will tomorrow be forced upon its timidity and will be succeeded by some third revolution, to be denounced and then adopted in its turn. American conservatism is merely the shadow that follows radicalism as it moves forward towards perdition. It remains behind it, but never retards it, and always advances near its leader. Its impotency is not hard indeed to explain. It is worthless because it is the conservatism of expediency only and not of sturdy principle. It intends to risk nothing serious for the sake of the truth and has no idea of being guilty of the folly of martyrdom. It always, when about to enter a protest, very blandly informs the wild beast whose path it essays to stop that it barks that its bark is worse than its bite, and that it only means to save its manners by enacting its decent role in re of resistance. The only practical purpose which it now serves in American politics is to give enough exercise to radicalism to keep it in wind and to prevent it becoming pursy and lazy from having nothing to whip. No doubt, after a few years, when women's suffrage shall have become an accomplished fact, conservatism will tacitly admit it into its creed, and thenceforward plume itself upon its wise firmness in opposing with similar weapons the extreme of baby suffrage. And when that too shall have been won, it will be heard declaring that the integrity of the American Constitution requires at least the refusal of suffrage to asses. There it will assume with great dignity its final position. I love this guy. It's so true today. He said this in 1897. I'd love to know who this guy is, if someone on the regular chat knows. This is so so real for what we're seeing today. Linux Foo says, lol, every media event, blah, blah, blah. Yes, okay. The thing is, the shootings are not government propaganda, but you are correct in your other observation that there are mass shootings on a regular basis that we don't hear about from the black community. There is definitely a differential treatment in the media with white shooting versus black shooting. No one looks at the weekend count of death in Chicago and says we have to have better gun laws. No one does this. Somehow, it's when a white person shoots people that somehow the regime activates itself to go after our gun rights. It's a special and weird observation, but yeah, it's happening. The post-millennial says Fox News airs segment celebrating transgender teen. Listen to this.
Pride Month continues as we highlight the story.
Pride Month continues, LGBTQ+, Pride Month, as we continue to highlight the stories of inspiration. This is CNN 4 years ago, celebrating Pride Month.
Story of Rylan Whittington, whose journey of transitioning at age 5 has been seen by 7 million people in a family YouTube video. Brian Yenis has a story about that family that hopes their experience can help others. Watch here.
If you saw me walking down the street, you wouldn't think anything different.
14-year-old Rylan Whittington is a typical Southern California teenager. And the Whittingtons, along with mom Hillary, dad Jeff, and sister Brinley, are a typical family. The only difference, though, in Rylan's eyes, is what this family can mean to the tens of thousands of kids under 18 who identify as transgender.
We put our story out there so people could...
So this is persuasion at this point. If you're putting your story out there so that other people do what you've ended up doing, this is more than opening the audience to an acceptance of someone else being trans, which is one thing. It is inviting others to adopt this lifestyle, which is a big problem in current society because there is social contagion happening on LGBT identity in teenagers. You have a lot of teenagers who are driven toward this lifestyle and who then regret it.
See that, like, there's another family out there that is going through what we're going through, or there's another family who's proud of who they are.
Before Rylan could even speak, he managed to tell his parents that he is a boy.
I could just see it wasn't him trying to be a brat. It was like painful. It was truly painful for him to have to wear feminine clothing and for us constantly telling him that you're a girl.
And unlike some trans kids, when Rylan came out at age 5 a few years later, he had the full support of his parents.
Initially, there was some pushback from us in trying to understand this.
We were confused like most.
So basically, the whole segment is cuddling with the lifestyle, is not presenting the negatives of it. They only mention the fact that he attempted suicide. Oh my God, he attempted suicide. Therefore, we have to sterilize him. It's going to get better then. It's so misleading because, first, this person is too young to have experienced the full consequences of their choice. So this person hasn't gone through the fatalistic realization that they won't have children. And when they get older and older, it will matter more to them. And perhaps then they will regret. Without that kind of coverage, this documentary, this journalistic report is completely misleading. It should have used a little more of the approach that was present in What is a Woman? This is why things like The Daily Wire, although I don't consider that The Daily Wire is perfect media, I think it has its own blind spots, but we have to have some alternatives to Fox News, because Fox News will not be there for maintaining a sort of pillar of right-wing belief. They are barely able to give fair coverage to the people who will be misled by this propaganda and driven into complete sterility. Sigidam Sengis says, sinister propaganda must be resisted and stopped. Absolutely. Linux Fu says, their choice made at 5 years old? Lol, per child abuse like vegan cats. Yes, I wonder, because these parents have accepted to pass on Fox News. Is it because they're right-wing? I don't know. I wonder what their attitude was. They say they resisted. Sometimes, you know, resistance is not the right way to go. Sometimes it's let the child be. He claims to be a boy for a couple of days. Let him be. Just don't drag attention. Don't drag your motherly attention to reward this. Mama JF, what's up?
Oh my God, the guy, he talks like Donald Trump.
He talks like Donald Trump? I didn't realize. I'll play it back and see if that's true.
You don't think so? He was like, yes, I'm a boy.
Perhaps he has learned his cues from Donald Trump. You know, trans people have models on the other sex that they get inspiration from, that they are trying to imitate.
No, that's not why I say that, because Owen Benjamin, he keeps saying that Donald Trump is a girl.
Donald Trump is a girl?
Because he keeps saying that like some girls are boys, you know, he keeps saying that.
Yeah, Owen Benjamin has been wrong a million times. So before, like, this is one of a conspiracy that is like 0.0001% chance of being right. I think he will have proven definitively that the moon landing didn't occur before he proves that Donald Trump is a girl. Now, Donald Trump, though, is a kind of narcissist. And narcissism sometimes leads you to adopt this fantastic kind of female behavior. But it's not female behavior. It's really the behavior of a man of appearance and care about his image.
Because you know what? He never had a beard.
He never had a beard.
Like, you can look all his picture, he never had.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised that he goes through waxing sessions. How do you call this in English?
You think?
So? I think he gets epilation. I would totally see Donald Trump invest on laser epilation stuff. He's totally that kind of guy. I mean, you've seen how he has maintained himself blonde for a unhealthy amount of time in his life. It's the guy cares about his image to a point where it's damaging to his own image.
Or
he's a girl.
I never saw somebody talk like that. It's the first one. Okay. And it's a female to male.
Okay. let's have a look at what Mama JF is saying. If we go back to the place where he speaks.
See that, like, there's another family out there that...
Oh, yeah, I see what she means. I see what Mama JF means. It's the kind of stern, forced forehead type of speech. Like, I'm trying to sound very, very intelligent right now. Yeah, let me tell you this. I have confidence, okay? I have more confidence than almost 99.9% of the people who have ever existed. Oh, yeah, that totally sounds like Donald Trump.
Going through what we're going through, or there's another family who's proud of who they are.
Before Rylan, could he...
Okay, well, I don't think it gives credence to the idea that Donald Trump is a girl, but he has definitely adopted some speech pattern from Donald Trump. Ariel Suarez says, how exactly did he make his skin orange? Some kind of weird permatan? Yeah, I would guess that we're talking about artificial tanning liquids. I know that there are creams that will make you tan even without sun, and they tend to they tend to give you that kind of carrot appearance. I know two people who have this weird tan appearance, Donald Trump and Raw Christina, the YouTuber, the vegan raw eating YouTuber. And yeah, I suspect that tanning is at play here. Val says, JF, sorry for the delay. Catching up on 2X, my quote was from Robert Lewis Dabney. Weird, you didn't see the name. It's normally at the top of the picture. Maybe it was scrolled down by default by Imgur. Okay, great to know. So Robert Lewis Dabney was the man who generated this brilliant quote. I want to comment on a series of videos by Academic Agent. Academic Agent Retrospective number 11, Critiquing Libertarianism. Don't trust this image here. It's an ad from YouTube and I just paused it. So Academic Agent considers that he has debunked libertarianism and that he has crushed it with facts and logic. And that's his compilation of, I believe, 5 or 6 streams of the past, which he compiled into a single 3.5-hour video. And he claims that this is the full, the complete debunking of his critique of libertarianism. Many of these videos, I had seen them. Many of these videos, I had seen them before, and I didn't... I knew that it wasn't a satisfactory attack of libertarianism to me, because I think Academic Agent is playing a kind of cultural Marxist game in his critique. He's critiquing libertarianism, showing connection between ideas. He's horseshoeing libertarianism, the same way Sargon of Akkad was horseshoeing the right of the internet. The thing is horseshoeing, showing that this position shares some resemblance with this other position at the extreme. Oh, horseshoe, it's all connected, it's all the same thing. This is not a valid critique. It's to explain to you how it's not valid, let's make a completely ridiculous horseshoe, which is that Adolf Hitler was drinking water and vegans are also drinking water. And therefore, there is a similar structure in everything that vegans do today and everything that Adolf Hitler did. And by the way, Adolf Hitler was also a vegan. Oh, we're starting to establish links here. I really don't like selecting Adolf Hitler as the ultimate evil example, but here, I did it because my mind couldn't find another example. Okay. even if you show resemblance between two things, and one thing has been demonstrated to be bad by your standard, and the other thing you claim therefore is bad, you're making an error of analogy and of non sequitur. It's not because two things share one characteristic that they are to be judged at the output by a moral system the same way. That's what Academic Agent does with libertarianism. He says libertarianism is like socialism, and he has two branches of argument on this. First, he says there is a hidden equality in libertarianism. He says, look, libertarianism, just like socialism, socialism is equality of outcome, of economic outcome and possession of things and private property. But libertarianism claims that everyone should be equally free. And therefore, there is an equality of freedom hidden in libertarianism. And to that, what I say is, just like the water example, you've identified a similarity. You've identified the word equality. The great difference in the equality of the liberty that is offered in libertarianism is that's the only equality. We say we will not extend further our judgment of what you deserve from life. We will offer you the equal respect of liberty, that is the liberty to make your choices. But if you make your choices in a way that is wrong, you you will get the punishments from it. So I don't mind about there being a little bit of equality. When you think about it, equality is intrinsic to the idea of a contract. When two people agree on something, they are implicitly saying, we are equal party, and here I will give you that much money and you'll give me that much wheat. By signing the contract as parties, they are basically coming to the table of the contract as equal. And they are mutually engaged in something that they committed to each other, and they will be held with some degree of equality of rights to both parties of the contract, equally in front of the law. To be combating any trace of equality as being bad is absolutely fallacious. And it's not because you can import the word equality from socialism and show that there's a little bit of it in libertarianism, that libertarianism imports the wrongs of socialism. The equality of socialism is wrong for a specific reason. It's because it's an equality that steps over the proper alignment of punishments. In other words, in socialism, the decision maker is not experiencing the bads of their choice, because through government control, the people who make the decisions are not the people living the consequences of these decisions. Under a big government, the people may very well decide to fund this activity and defund this activity, and you have, in the end, people being deprived of a service they needed and wanted by the collective. That's why the equality of socialism is bad. It's because it's an equality of outcomes independent of the capacity to do the right decision. The right decision having been defined as that which pleases the collective. Libertarianism has an equality in it. It's an equality of freedom. The equality of, yeah, you can wreck your life and I won't stop you from it. You can pursue studies in an unproductive field, but you're going to have to pay for all of it. And you can go study in stuff that won't result in you getting a job, but you'll be stuck with your debt and you'll be stuck with whatever are the consequences of you not being able to get a job. There's no problem with that equality. It's a perfectly aligned equality where the people who are responsible for the decision end up paying for it. His second critique of libertarianism is, he says, there is another parallel to socialism. Socialism implicitly assumes that the material well-being of people is to be pursued and is what will lead to their happiness, or is the axioms that should be pursued or maximized, because the people who are Marxist believe that society will be better managed under socialism, and that the products of society will be available to people in abundance. So there's the base of materialistic pursuit of socialism. And he claims libertarianism, by having all these economic arguments underlying it, is therefore also saying and assuming that material good is the thing to pursue. And the problem here is that libertarianism does not, it is independent of content of pursuit. You can be a libertarian and wish for a world that wouldn't be as productive as ours, or as productive as any society of freedom in the past. You can be a libertarian and wish for a world in which everyone's ends up adhering to a very authoritarian religion, but they do so voluntarily. You can be a libertarian and see everyone becoming farmers and working on very small, simple lifestyle of sustainability and survivance without pursuing high productivity. the economic argument for libertarianism is there, and I think that societies have shown that through a relatively free market, we develop faster and we end up producing more goods. But that doesn't have to be the case. Under libertarianism, you are totally free not to go work for the workshop and get a land and be a farmer and do whatever you want that's unproductive. The point of libertarianism is you can only do so to the extent that you can afford that lifestyle, and you can afford also paying the price, the consequences of this lifestyle. If it ends up that your life is less productive than your than other people who go work for the workshop. So I think he's making a false assumption about what libertarianism is about. It's not about pursuing material wealth. It's about the liberty to pursue material wealth or pursue any other form of wealth if you'd like to. So he talks of transcendence. He gives the description of a blacksmith and how, oh my God, past societies, from a libertarian perspective, they were oppressive because they were forcing the son of the blacksmith to become a blacksmith. And he says, isn't it more a transcendental good existence to be forced into something, to know that it's your purpose and to know that society expects you to be a blacksmith? He talks of the anxiety of choice and how the modern world ultimately creates less happiness by giving people the choice of what they want to do. They say if we imposed it on them, perhaps they'd be more happy. That doesn't matter to me, because in libertarianism, you are free to impose something on yourself. There's nothing in libertarianism that keeps the son of the blacksmith to become the new blacksmith also. It's totally fine. So I think there is a false assumption about what libertarianism is and the degree of freedom that is allowed for the pursuits of everyone's dream. And if someone's dream is to experience the transcendental experience of living a religious lifestyle and becoming a blacksmith against their will, they can do that in libertarianism. So I feel that the attack on libertarianism is generally very weak from academic agent, and it relies mostly on pinpointing a specific argument from a given author rather than see libertarianism as an open framework, really. An open framework for how do we handle society in a world of non-aggression. And it's not to mean that aggression hasn't existed or that it won't even appear in the libertarian society, but how do we manage the relationship between different humans who would come to a table and try to agree to not kill each other? And libertarianism, to me, is the answer. It's since we are at a table to discuss how to formulate society, let us not formulate a society that will oppress you, and let us not formulate a society that will oppress me. The minute this contract is broken, the minute someone starts talking about, oh, well, I'm going to tax you a little more here, and the minute you breach this little equality that remains under libertarianism, then you breach the social contract, and you might as well pull the sword, and you're in a war. Patricius says, well, there you disagree with him just morally. That is not a false assumption. He values that a society that is ordered. Well, he makes the assumption that libertarianism is only pursuing material well-being. Now, to me, I should say that everything that he calls transcendental and other forms of well-being, all of this to me is material well-being, because ultimately it boils down to brain states and realities of the physical universe. Even if you think that God exists and you feel it as good, that is still a physical experience. But it's not the case that libertarianism is optimized particularly to handle people's pursuit of material wealth. As far as I'm concerned, the closest thing to a libertarian society is early America for white people, And it wasn't a society aligned on industrial production from the beginning. It eventually became one, but it was mostly a society aligned on farming, and where the vast majority of people didn't benefit from massive production lines. Patricia says, Ariel, not actually humans are evolved to do what they are told. They are happy to get orders. Most people, at least some are not, but most people enjoy a stable personality and a given purpose. Also, their family would tell them that it is a good thing to follow your father, you will get a house, etc. Well, there's no problem with this. There is a place for sheepish humans, cattle type humans in libertarian society. In fact, it's only in a libertarian society that they truly can enjoy their submissiveness. There is nothing in a libertarian society. There is no one who will knock at your door for submitting to orders. So you can enjoy your life as a order follower. The best society for this, in fact, is a libertarian society. Because in a non-libertarian society, there will eventually be a fight for who gives orders to who. And which orders did you follow that were good, and which orders did you follow that were not good? That's pretty much the current state of society. See, I've followed a rational process in my life, in my whole media life and thinking life and writing life. I followed the principles of rationality that were pushed by the early atheist and secularist. And I pushed it to an extreme that they didn't like. And I followed the ideals of diversity that have been pushed by the left. And I was so for diversity that I even diversified my show by inviting people like David Duke. And they didn't like that kind of diversity. All this to say, the order follower in a tyrannical society is living in a nightmare. The best society for an order follower is libertarianism, because in libertarianism, you will never be reproached to being too much of an order follower, because it's your liberty. Nicholas Petris says, epic paradigm, JF. No, but it's true. When you think about it, our society is extremely psychologically abusive to young people. It's telling them one thing, and then it kind of has these non-written rules, which I love to step on. I love to drive a truck through the non-written rules, but I love this because it exposes people for who they truly are. See, in 2000, from 2005 to 2010, to 2000, in fact, 2017, from 2005 to 2017, you would have consulted the web and you would have had the impression that there are people who are totally against fallacies and they follow the rational principles and they wouldn't dismiss someone on an ad hominem. I was like, oh my God, what a welcoming society. I can be anyone I want in this. And they will still consider my arguments, see? They will still get to my book, these secularists, these atheist plus guy, these people of rationality. They will not care about however I soil my name. They will get back to my argument and they say, JF, your argument is valid or your argument is invalid and here's why. All of these people have been exposed since then, since what we've done in 2017 up to now. We have exposed society as not being truly liberal. And we have exposed the secularist as not being truly rational. That's what we've done. I'm pretty proud of it. By the way, people were telling me that Martin Shkreli is now streaming on the internet. That might be a good target. Martin Shkreli, I feel that this guy will stick to his principle. I don't know why. I don't know why, because he promotes himself as the most hated man in the world. and he's out of jail for his fraud, whatever fraud accusations that were against him. And I think he somehow, I trust this guy. Somehow I think that this guy is a misunderstood person in the world, and that he feels like maybe the most moral person I know, okay? Because I think that you don't go through that much shit in terms of turning the market and profiting from super dirty situations. You don't do that if you're not highly principled. I believe that Martin Shkreli might be the most moral person in the world right now. That's somehow a conviction. I haven't spoken to the guy, but I think he should be our next target to get interested in the revolutionary phenotype. Because the guy likes future predictions. He likes to manipulate the markets and all. And so I think that him understanding what's about to happen in terms of genetic modifications should be a priority. So I don't know if you guys are in contact with him. I'm not on Twitter. I'm banned from Twitter. But if you guys know his stream, where it's happening, I have no idea. But send him a super chat, or send him a chat or a DM on Twitter. Martin Shkreli, I believe, may be the most moral guy that exists. I'm not saying this to kiss his ass so that he reads my book. I'm actually convinced that you don't go through everything he's been doing without an inner behavioral code. I think he's a little bit like Dexter. He follows a plan. He follows a behavioral code inside of him that's very different from the current society, but that is truly honorable when you look at it from inside. I'd love to get to know the guy. Silver Spider says, Jeff, what are you saying? What you are saying now sounds exactly like a Stefan Molyneux speech. You guys should team up at least on libertarianism. We teamed up. We teamed up and we did a modern day debate together against two communists. And, you know, me and Stefan Molyneux teaming up, I'm afraid to tell you, is the limiting factor in this happening. Because I've many times talked to Stefan about, we have to talk about the revolutionary phenotype, Stefan. He never gave a shit, always talked to me in a dismissive fashion, always disrespected me, even when he invited me on his show. At the end of the show, somehow ends the show, a philosophical discussion about first principles, where I delivered, you know, you can disagree with me, but he can't disagree that I delivered philosophical, rational positions. And he ends the show by saying, oh yeah, I have to go wash my clothes. And these little digs that he seemed to think he's taking at me. And also in the modern day debate, before the modern day debate began, I never revealed this. But I can reveal it today. Before the modern day debate began, we were not live, and James of Modern Day was saying, hey, is it you guys' first time? It's great that you guys are together for the first time. And I said, no, James, we've had a debate before, but it was me against him. It's the first time we are tag team on the same side for capitalism. And but we have once argued for against moral realism, moral nihilism before, and James didn't know, and he said, oh, I didn't know that, oh, it's great. And Stefan Molyneux said, well, you know, we're on the same side tonight, that's if we don't end up jumping at each other's throat during the debate because we disagree on so much things. He threw this, like he didn't feel me. He didn't respect the possibility that someone who would disagree with his meta-ethical framework could be a true capitalist. And that's sad, because it shows a fundamental misunderstanding. Stefan Molyneux does not... Stefan Molyneux feels everything that he is as one thing. He cannot see when I consider my position, when I consider my position on something that I truly, like, I'm attached to, the revolutionary phenotype, I can totally imagine, oh, well, there could be someone else who believes chapter 1, 2, 3, 4, but disagrees with chapter 5. Or I could take someone who believes in all of the book but disagrees with the principle of everlasting fingerprints. Or maybe someone agrees with the whole theory for RNA but doesn't think it's going to happen again in humanity, therefore doesn't believe in chapter 12. I'm capable of this. Stefan is incapable of this. Stefan had the impression and has the impression that you cannot be a capitalist or libertarian proper if you're not a moral realist. And that shows a lack of imagination on his part. Anyways, much love to Stefan Molyneux, and I would love to talk again with him. But yeah, the idea of an interaction happening is definitely the limiting factor. James says, Stefan attacked me as well 7 years ago for criticizing his opinion on Christianity. Yeah, I think he's a little, you know, like these autists who have difficulty if you break one aspect of their routine. It's like you just committed an act of aggression. I think he's a little bit like this. By the way, if you'd like to support the show, use the dollar button under the Odyssey regular chat. The Odyssey super chats are my favorite way to receive support for the show and receive your questions. Alternatively, if you don't like the platform, you can use Entropy. The link to Entropy is in the description below. Someone was trying to get an attack on the revolutionary phenotype. It wasn't very smart, so, but I've still been interacting with this guy for 19 replies, trying to explain to him what he gets wrong. Let's read a little bit of the conversation so that you guys get an idea, but it's not... A lot of people think they can debunk selfish gene IDs, and they don't realize so much work has been done. Like, they're years behind, and they don't realize it. Like, you have to read my book. Yeah, you have to. I've thought about whether consciousness could be a replicator's. I've laid out in a book why it's not. He says, Jeff, I've thought about this more, and I can't get past the idea that from your replicator's point of view, it would seem that consciousness, even if it is simply emergent, and therefore not strictly subject to selection, is evolutionarily a dead end. Where do we even begin here? Consciousness being emergent is not an argument that would lead it to not being subject to selection. It's not because something is emergent that it's not subject to selection. The wing of a bird is emergent. It's an emergent property from how the cells of the body of the bird are organized. It's an emergent property of how the particular molecules in those cells arrange themselves eventually in the form of a wing. So the wing is an emergent property, yet it is subject to evolution. And then consciousness is an evolutionary dead end. So I ask, how so? Seems like if consciousness serves the animal well evolutionarily, it can stay for an arbitrary amount of time and be shaped by evolution. He answers, if the animal is simply a machine for the replicator, then the emergent phenomenon of consciousness gives the machine an override option in the replication process. This does not seem like an optimal position for the replicator. So he's basically saying, well, consciousness allows suicide, therefore it's in contradiction with evolution. But as I explained to him, anything in the phenotype can potentially lead to death. I say any phenotypic machine can be seen as an override option. Your heart could stop beating, stopping your replication process. Consciousness is not special in this regard. In certain environments, it will keep you from breathing, but then it will evolve to fix itself. So the phenotype is always subjected to, oh, well, a new environment comes, and in that new environment, the phenotype that used to be good for replication isn't good anymore. This can be true of consciousness, it can be true of hearts, it can be true of arms. See, it has happened a couple of times in evolution that people lost their arms. People, species, like lizards lost their arms to become snakes. Dinosaurs lost their arms to become birds. So sometimes a machine stops your replication process, and the minority of your species that suddenly is born without this machine ends up outcompeting you. Silver Spider sends a super chat. Thank you so much for supporting the show. He says, it's a shame that more libertarians can't work together. I did watch the libertarian versus communism debate, and I could see Stefan always wanting to be in charge and emotional, whereas you were more laid back. Leftists always stick together, and I think that's why they take over everything. You're absolutely correct. And I tried basically to create a right-wing community of sort by imposing a standard, the standard that we won't play the game of cancel culture. And this is the story of the failure of the right. It's that the right adheres to behavioral standards imposed by the left and imposed by mainstream media. So the right is not intelligent enough to win the culture war. That's a big problem. They play right in the... Because in 2017, there was a moment at which cancel culture could have been totally abandoned by the right. And it would have been one of the plaything of the left. And no, it didn't happen. And I started seeing these trends of people flocking to regular chats saying, oh my God, how are you still talking to Richard Spencer? He's so off on his opinions, like so 2011. He's been discredited. And it's like, bro, you're using language that I would expect to see by some radical communist who's trying to have me not listen to a voice of reason. You're dismissing someone based on their name and who they are rather than the argument that they're specifically stating in front of you. The right has totally fell for cancel culture and ad hominem, and I tried to create a different world and it didn't work. Because the mass of stupid people on this planet is just too overwhelming. There's just no... Let's see, Tillman. JF, Richard Spencer is a fad. See, there you go. There you go. Tillman, you are part of who I'm describing. Thomas O'Ward says, serious question. Is it possible for a libertarian society to exist outside of a Christian Western society civilization? Hard to find a counterexample. If a libertarian society reemerged, how could its principle be preserved in the long term without negating some of them in some way? Well, you know what? Certainly, libertarianism relies on high trust, low criminality. Because if you're in an environment of high criminality or high possibilities for corruptions, you're just not going to get to the point where it's good to have contracts and it's good to have consent. However, I wouldn't be surprised that A lot of little pockets of libertarianism have been existing in our evolutionary history. Here and there, at times, people living at the edge of bigger civilizations, people living distantly. I have this personal conviction that maybe the intra-tribe structure of Native Americans before they encountered Europeans, maybe there was some amount of libertarianism to it. I remind myself the writings of Roland Viot on this, who was describing, for instance, that someone could choose to commit suicide in traditional Native American society, and that they would take the time to say goodbye to their loved ones, and they would not try to physically stop them from doing so. And I think there might have been some libertarian aspect to it, although the Native Americans were fighting against other tribes, and they were basically involved in wars for their existential survival. So that was definitely not a libertarian aspect, but within the tribe, there may have been something like libertarianism going on. It was definitely not the European style with contracts and commitments and marriage, but it was its own style. And I think that there may have been a lot of isolated families basically living libertarian-like existence for all that mattered to them, simply because there was no lord coming to dominate them, and they had achieved an independent existence of some kind. But they will be hard to retrace as societies that have left traces. All right, continuing our review of this Gab post, I pointed out that, yeah, basically any piece of your phenotype can kill you. Imagine if a meteorite came and basically annihilated everything alive on Earth, or perhaps everything that's bigger than 100 micrometers, or, you know, maybe leaving only bacteria alive. Then you could say that being bigger than a bacteria is a bad thing for surviving on planet Earth. That basically the bacteria outcompeted us thanks to their meteorite shields that's built into them, in them being small enough that they don't get killed by the meteorite. So any part of the phenotype, any part of the universe can kill an arbitrary amount of replicators, and that's not a contradiction of the theory of evolution. That's precisely what Richard Dawkins was explaining in The Selfish Gene. He says a lot of people think that because you can kill all replicators of a subset or all of the replicators that you know of, that suddenly the theory of evolution isn't true. But it's actually more true that moment. If you start killing all life forms that are bigger than bacteria, then it's just bacteria just outcompeted the life forms that were bigger than bacteria. If the hearts stop working, the heart of all mammals stop working on planet Earth because of some poison in the air or some maybe lack of oxygen, then the life forms that had hearts were unfit to live on planet Earth without oxygen or with the poison. So this is still the theory of evolution. It's still the selfish gene going on. Andrew says, maybe so, but only consciousness would allow for it on a species-wide level. There is no upper limit on the override option available as a result of consciousness. Of course there is. He's talking about the possibility of all of humanity through consciousness committing suicide or destroying everything that's alive on Earth. I've just given all sorts of examples where nature comes to destroy everything that's alive on Earth. And I give further examples in the discussion. I say if a predator was to show and it really eats everything around it, bacteria, mammals, no matter what. Oh, I have my my greenhouse lights that I've just lighted up. I forgot to shut them off, but it's not really affecting the screen. It's just giving a little purple haze here, so that's fine. So even if you had a big predator that shows up on planet Earth, starts eating everything up to the point where there's nothing left to eat eventually, to eat, and the predator dies, that would be an example of a phenotypic machine produced through replication that ends up killing itself. It's not contrary to the theory of evolution. And there are severe obstacles to the whole of humanity committing suicide because of consciousness. It's like there's not a single ID. You cannot push the whole of humanity to commit suicide. Eventually you're gonna bump on some people are gonna be like, hey, those are bad IDs. I'd rather follow what God says. God says, have babies, be fruitful and multiply. I'm gonna do this instead of listening to your suicide advice. And then what? Then the people who commit suicide end up eliminating themselves, they disappear from the gene pool, and all you have left are people who say, be fruitful and multiply, trust God, and they're alive. They've outcompeted you evolutionarily. I say, yes, there is. All sorts of preferences can be hard-coded into the brain, including stubbornness and religiosity, which will protect from incoming deleterious IDs. He says, those won't be encoded in every brain, but that's the whole idea. That if you convince some people to commit suicide, it's only going to be a limited number, and there's going to be people left surviving this event, and eventually these people will not be convincible of suicide in the future. If you were to reattempt your process, it wouldn't work. He says, those won't be encoded in every brain. You can imagine a person or even an entire species of conscious beings who determine that all life must be eliminated. What in the replication process could stop them from doing so if they acquired the necessary technology? I said, the same thing that is the source of every single evolutionary adaptation, random variation. Inevitably, those who are committed to their own disappearance end up killing themselves at a higher rate than those who are committed to their own continued existence. On the next generation, only those who have the brain features that lead to survival exist. The other ones are all gone. You make the mistake of assuming that humanity is connected together through a kind of uniform hive mind. It isn't. People are going crazy with this consciousness is so special. Consciousness is unique. And I won't read all of the words of the discussion, but it ends on this point, that he's convinced that consciousness is so unique. And it's like, have you considered the possibility that being unique is not so unique? Like, the squirrels are unique in their squirrelness. The humans are unique in their consciousness. Well, maybe they are, or maybe they're not. The humans are certainly unique in their language. The birds are unique in their capacity to fly. Everyone is unique. So unique is the most common thing you have in life. And the fact that consciousness is unique, at least he claims that it's unique, doesn't change a thing. It's not the trap that you think it is for the selfish gene view of evolution. I will read the end of this conversation where he says, well, the meteorite, blah, blah, blah. He says, your book is about a phenotypic revolution involving DNA and AI. Could you imagine consciousness becoming the new replicator, wherein everything we do as an organism is an attempt to replicate parts of our own consciousness? I don't mean to argue. These are just thought experiments, and I'm happy to have your input. I say, they are wrong thoughts. I have gone through this thinking. The results are in my book. I recommend you read it to understand where you are wrong. Here are a couple of pointers. One, You treat the existence of consciousness with a double standard. Mama JF is here.
Oh my god, yeah, the Wolverine is outside.
The Wolverine is outside?
Yes.
I'm gonna go. That is not a Wolverine, Mama JF. Not a Wolverine. False flag Wolverine.
It was not this you saw. That
That's a raccoon.
Oh my god. Evan, I heard the big bug, bug, bug. Then I was like, oh my god, I went outside. I was standing next to him.
They're making extreme noise during the night. They're like.
Right, damn.
Yeah. Yeah, they fight against the cats.
You think? No, I think they're having sex.
Maybe they're having sex, maybe. Now, that was a giant raccoon, but not a Wolverine.
Oh my god.
Definitely not what I saw when I saw a Wolverine.
Oh, really? Damn. I was standing this next to him.
Oh my god.
Oh my god.
Well, well, well. Okay, so my answer to him. They are wrong thoughts. One, he uses a double standard because he always keeps saying consciousness is unique. It's not like these other examples you bring. And it's like all these other examples are unique too. It would be pretty unique for a meteorite to destroy all life on Earth. It would be pretty unique for a predator to eat everything around them. But they could exist the same way a human consciousness that wants to destroy everything could exist. It doesn't exist because evolution generally doesn't push that way. Two, contrary to his claim, consciousness is a product of evolution. Three, you fawn over the uniqueness of consciousness, but you don't realize that uniqueness is not an uncommon attribute in nature. Squirrels are unique in their squirrelness, yet you're not here claiming that the uniqueness of squirrels justifies a completely non-evolutionary view of their squirrelness. 4. My book goes through what consciousness would need to do to become a new replicator. See chapter 9. It would need to become a trickster printer. I.e. it would need to start printing and farming human genomes. Then it would be a revolutionary phenotype. In other words, consciousness would have to do the very same thing that DNA did when it became a revolutionary phenotype of RNA 4 billion years ago. Consciousness does not escape the laws of nature, including the theory of phenotypic revolutions. These discussions are exhausting me because I've been doing it since 2015 now, explaining stuff on the internet. And I'm at that point where every single counter I get, I've encountered before, I've addressed before, and it's wrong. And I feel like there's this limit of communication with the world. It's like, the world is really stubborn and stupid and impenetrable. Anyways, I continue doing what I want to do and saying these things, but I don't have the impression that humanity is capable of understanding its wrongs and its fallacies. New evidence shows humans in North America 23,000 years ago at the height of the Ice Age. They say, they always say this, much earlier than previously thought. But to me, 23,000-year-old is not, I'm not surprised that there were humans in North America. They say previously thought. Who was thinking this? Because I'm not surprised. I was always finding that the theory that Native Americans have emerged as basically a separate race like genetically distinguished race within 7,000 years, I've always found that this was unrealistic. But now we have footprints apparently in the White Sands National Park that would be 23,000 years old. Silver Spider says, Jeff, there is no more convincing evidence of evolution to me than differences in intelligence between humans. That was the last straw. Oh, well, okay, maybe that's your personal trajectory in understanding evolution, but let me tell you, the intelligence differences in humans are the last argument I would use to make a case for evolution. Not that it's not true. It's true, but I don't see it as the most convincing argument, because there's all these sorts of blurring attacks that the leftists will pull. And it's like, if you want to be convinced of evolution, just look at how, just look at the series of cranium from the reptilian anapsid, like turtles, down to the reptilian diapsids, like birds. And that is a solid case. Just look at how the wings of bird are made of arms. And just look at how the wings of bats are made of fingers. Those are strong arguments for evolution. Human intelligence, you'll always have so much blurring being done on it that it's not even worth you want to debate human intelligence, but you don't want to use it as your pillar of belief for evolution. Now, I understand that human intelligence may touch the sensibility of the layman much more than the analysis of reptilian craniums. But to me, it was much more the reptilian craniums and the bones and the anatomy tracking in phylogeny combined with the genetic analysis. It's like, poof, two truths that can only be explained by one theory. Based says, do you know who Matt Ridley is? Have you read anything by him? If so, what did you think? If you deem him relevant, maybe send him a copy. Matt Ridley, I think I've reviewed one of his books. A British science writer. But what did he write? No, I've not reviewed his books. I've not reviewed his books. I would have to pick one. If you have a favorite one that you think is the best of Matt Ridley, you should tell me. Of course, he's the author of The Red Queen, Sex and the Evolution of Human Nature. Would that be the best book to read? I would totally read it and do a review. But definitely, yes, we should get these people. Since Brett Weinstein doesn't seem available to read a book of science, we should definitely try to get Martin Shkreli and Matt Ridley to read The Revolutionary Phenotype. I mean, they weren't my first choice, but Brett Weinstein is not available to be taught something fundamental about life. So I have to go for my second choice. What is white gay privilege? It is a sad reality that being part of a marginalized societal group exposes you to hate, discrimination, and unequal treatment. This fact is well known by people in the LGBTQ+ community who experience this kind of hostility based on their gender and or their sexuality. However, for people whose identities intersect multiple marginalized groups, there are more things to consider. For LGBTQ+ people of color, racism also impacts how they are perceived and treated by wider society. So people from the LGBTQ+ community who do not also have to worry about racism possess white gay privilege. And here we go again. This is amazing because we're going to go through the full circle once again. But this time, it's gay white men who are going to be the target. This time I'm out of job. This time I'm not in the wrestling cage, you see. Now you had this whole gay white men basically were the most successful civil rights progress because everyone got behind gay marriage. Gay marriage is the goal. And then eventually, so they developed this success. And you know, if you're a gay white man, you don't need trans people in your life because you're going to be mostly attracted to cisgender males. You don't even need females in your life. Imagine that. Because you're interested in males. Now, so they were successful in their civil rights pursuits. But eventually you had, as the skit of Owen Benjamin presents it, eventually you have the B, the T, and the Q joining the ride. And at this point, they are joining the ride to the point of seeing within their little community internal injustices, internal lack of equality. Because they realize, well, now that gay white men have been mainstreamed, they have it much better than trans, black, I don't know, whatever other intersections of minority status you could combine that makes your life worse than a gay white man. So now they're going to go after the gay white man, and I think we're going to start seeing a phenomenon that I know has existed since the very beginning, but that has been kept in silence in leftist circles, the great bigotry of the homosexual white man. That basically the homosexual white man is more bigoted than the cisgender white heterosexual. If anything, the cisgender white heterosexual is just going with the flow on so many things and is showing himself so open. But the homosexual gay white man has kind of self-selected for his bigotry. I mean, he wanted so much males. He wanted males so much that he's decided to live this alternative lifestyle where he wouldn't have access to parenthood, at least not biological parenthood. He's given up a lot of things. He's given up a lot of things for becoming a gay man. And I think he will have ultimately self-selected for a little more bigotry. A little more bigotry than your average straight guy. And it shows in how homosexuals sometimes will talk about a woman. I think many of them have actually been driven down this road due to a hate of women, like a profound discomfort and disgust at women. I'm not saying it in a critical fashion. It's like, oh, you can feel that way, okay. It's like, but, and I'm not hating on the homosexuals here, but I think many of them have just been turned off either by a kind of abuse moment. Like they've been totally abused by a female and they started really associating females with a negative experience, or they've been instinctively disgusted at females from the very beginning and they adopted the alternative lifestyle because it was the only out from partnering with a female. I think that we're going to see this in full display. Because the homosexual community has now been joined by a group that is so diverse of people with different claims of oppression. And I don't think it's that much in the interest of the homosexual guy anymore to pose as a victim. I think they will have walked past this very soon. So I think you're going to end up having this fabulous homosexual guy behavior who will display kind of love of life and an enjoyment of his situation and a kind of refusal of being a victim. And yet you're going to have those who join the group a little later, the trans, the others, the queers, and they're going to still be in the victimhood complex. There's going to be a clash in this community, I believe. Just a conflict of interest, a disalignment, and perhaps less political common ground. NASA's, this will be our last news item, NASA's $10 billion space telescope hit by micrometeoroid. So they had 18 beryllium gold tiles that were basically used as reflectors to eventually concentrate the signal to a single point, which allows to see further and to see more and to see fainter images better. Now, as it turns out, a micrometeorite, the size of a grain of sand, it seems. A micrometeorite the size of, like, dust. Just a dust particle. Poof! But a dust particle, when you add the speeds at which these things are going, it's enough to break one of the 18 mirrors here. Now, they are saying they do plan their missions in a way where they take that possibility into account. So they had extra mirrors, basically, so that losing one still doesn't totally abolish their functionality. But they're saying that losing one as early in the mission as they did was unexpected, and it's above the standard that they had expected. So it's like, for now, it's not dramatic. But if they keep meeting these meteorites at a higher frequency than originally expected, it might eventually compromise the functionality of the James Webb Space Telescope. That is it for tonight, boys. Don't forget that tomorrow is our Patreon Subscribe Star Hangout. It will be at 9 p.m. Eastern Time or whenever the show ends. And join the Patreon or the Subscribe Star if you want to support the show on a monthly basis. Much love and see you all tomorrow.